Salo Falava. I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Talofa, malo, pulavinaka, and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia, coming to you live from Papua New Guinea's capital, Port Moresby. I'm Belinda Cora. Thanks for joining in wherever you might be. Coming up today, fears gold prices could fall as PNG hands down its national budget. Also, Timor-Leste's 50th independence anniversary prompts mixed feelings.
We have been really governing the country in such a way that I do not agree, and happy because I'm still alive.
And is PNG's population really what the census says it is?
It would appear that a large portion of the population was omitted.
All that and more coming up. I'm Belinda Cora. Let's get started. Surfers wanting to catch a wave in Fiji could soon have to pay for the privilege as the government moves to repeal a unique law that opened access to tourists and locals alike. Back in 2010, the surfing decree removed the exclusive access rights of foreign-owned resorts to famous waves like Cloudbreak, so anyone could surf anywhere they liked. But it also removed the rights of traditional owners over the marine areas and surfing hotspots and their ability to generate income for them. The government says that it's unfair, though what exactly will replace the decree remains unclear, as Liam Fox reports.
Fiji's surfing decree is a rare thing. It's one of the few laws enforced on the country during a dark period of military dictatorship that appears to have had a lasting positive impact.
We lobbied and we opened the waves in 2010, and surfers from all over the world. It was historic. People flew in. People all were celebrating.
Ian Revolvo Muller is one of Fiji's surfing pioneers. 30 years ago, he was one of the first kids to carry a board under his arm around the tourist town of Nandi. Back then, locals couldn't surf internationally renowned waves like Cloudbreak. Most tourists couldn't either.
We as locals couldn't surf, and we were treated as second-class citizens in our own country. And I mean, who would like a situation that we're in where you can't even surf your own waves?
That's because foreign-owned resorts held exclusive access rights to waves like Cloudbreak, so you had to be a guest to surf them. In 2010, the surf decree changed all that. It prohibited exclusive access rights, so anyone could surf any wave in the country without having to pay a fee or get a permit. Even critics of the then government acknowledged it helped turn Fiji into a premier surf tourism location. Ian Revolvo Muller says it also helped develop the sport of surfing in the country.
It allowed us to start surfing locals, local businesses to start flourishing. I mean, ever since we've opened, there's been an explosion of local surf businesses and local surfers surfing. It's incredible. That's why we got all these young up-and-coming stars now, because they're able to surf the best, you know, some of the best waves in the world.
But while some locals got in on surfing-related businesses, the indigenous owners of the coastlines and seas where people were surfing could only look on as others profited. The decree removed their rights to control access to their resources. It also banned other activities from surfing areas, like fishing. The tourism minister, Bill Gavoka, says that's unfair.
No one was allowed to receive any compensation. So it denied the resource owners huge opportunities to make something out of their resources.
He says a long-foreshadowed bill to revoke and replace the surfing decree will go to Parliament next week. What exactly will replace it, though, remains unclear.
In place will be a structure that is designed to A, liberalize access to all the marine areas, and B, to ensure that the resource owners are compensated for the use of their marine areas.
Has that structure been determined yet, or is that to be developed after the legislation is in place?
It will come into Parliament next week, and it will go through the normal process with the bills, and it will go out to committees to hear the views of the citizenry. But the fundamental, the each part of the equation is that when you access the marine areas, you compensate the resource owners.
How will that work? Will resource owners be able to set their own costs or set their own rates per visit? How do you think it'll work?
No, it'll be through dialogue across the board. No one will be charging anything that is out of line.
The change and lack of concrete information on what comes next is causing some concern. No one from the Fiji Surfing Association or the Fiji Hotels and Tourism Association wanted to comment, with both groups saying they don't have enough information and they're waiting to see the new law when it's tabled in Parliament. Ian Ravovo-Mulla has a foot in both camps. He's a surfer who runs a surf-related business, and he has Indigenous Fijian ancestry.
Our people haven't been fairly been compensated. That's been their fishing grounds. Surfers come in, they chase away the fish, they have no fish to eat. They need to be compensated. They destroy the reefs. They need to be compensated.
When the public consultations begin, Ian says he'll be floating a proposal for a way forward, a maritime version of national parks.
Having an ocean park where it's a user pay, and that money goes back into lifeguards, security, village, reef protection, making sure that, you know, the ocean and the people are looked after and it's sustainable. And it could be a great, great model for the rest of the world.
Fijian surfing pioneer there, Ian Ravovo-Mulla, ending that report from Leon Fox.
Pacific Beat.
To Papua New Guinea now, where high gold prices have delivered the Papua New Guinea government a significant revenue boost, according to the budget handed down earlier this week. But those high prices may not continue, and chief economist at professional services firm PwC, Lucy Lomas, says the government needs to continue efforts to diversify the economy. Ms. Lomas was in the budget lockup at Parliament House and says the government looks to have handed down a balanced budget.
Gold has reached above $4,000 an ounce in response to greater demand for it due to the uncertainty globally. And gold is PNG's largest commodity export. So understanding what the assumptions were in the budget around the gold price was an area that I was keen to have a look at. And there was a substantial upward revision in the assumed realised price of gold exports, which do play into the budget outcome. So effectively, the people of PNG, through their gold exports, are directly benefiting from what's going on globally through additional revenue flowing through a higher profitability for the gold sector here. So there's an additional $900 an ounce that's been assumed that would be received from gold exports. And there's also a little bit of an increase in gold production as well, which so the combinations and the higher prices means that there's been a little bit of a windfall in this budget for the PNG government and the citizens of Papua New Guinea. Really, this budget is a story about gold.
Is there a bit of a risk in this strategy because of its reliance on world prices staying high?
Absolutely. And so one of the things that we look for in budgets where there is a reliance on traded goods and the prices received for those traded goods is what are the fundamentals behind price changes or volume changes? And as I flagged earlier, partly what's driving up the gold price is increased demand globally because of the level of uncertainty. So, for example, many foreign reserve holdings of gold have been increased by central banks. And then investors as well are looking to hold more gold as a way of sort of hedging against risk. The challenge with that, where you're building that revenue into your budget, is that as quickly as the world discovered that it was in an uncertain place, and that certainly coincided with the change in administration in the US, things could change the other way as well. Now, I suspect that's probably unlikely, but there is definitely a risk element in here that prices could come down faster or at a level below that is that has been assumed in this budget. And often you would see some deliberately conservative assumptions around price growth to kind of hedge against that risk. So yes, there is a little bit of risk in this budget, but I would say that is not unusual. I think overall, I think PNG is probably okay for now, but it'll be something to keep an eye on.
What was your impression of the overall budget?
My overall impression of the budget was that it was a nicely balanced budget. There are some real challenges for a government such as the PNG in working and developing up a budget, which is to ensure that there's sufficient spending on day-to-day essential services while also investing in infrastructure, because it's the infrastructure investment that often is key to enabling economic growth to be maintained or lifted into the future. So I always look for a sort of a balance between the two, and I would say that that's certainly something that I would observe in this budget. There is ongoing commitment to invest in the road network, ports, water supplies, energy supplies, which is obviously particularly difficult to deliver in a geography like PNG's that's, mountainous and where there's populations dispersed over the whole country. And then I would be looking for additional expenditure into education, health and the like. And there's certainly, there was a 9% increase in expenditure in those sorts of areas. Probably the surprise in here was that there is definitely a deliberate attempt to stimulate non-resource sector economic activity, and agriculture was the winner in this budget. There is additional funding in there for the Department of Agriculture, research, things like the cocoa and coconut sector, as well as fisheries.
That's Chief Economist at PricewaterhouseCoopers, Lucy Lomas there.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Papua New Guinea's population stands at just over 10 million people, according to the latest census figures, which were just released last month. But one prominent economist in PNG is questioning this figure, as well as how the census itself was run. Paul Baka is the director of the Institute of National Affairs, an independent think tank. I spoke to him earlier on, and I started by asking him what he thought went wrong with the census.
They allocated a fairly tight budget in comparison with previous census operations. You do need to do a lot of preparation for a census, including up-to-date village mapping, so you know roughly where the population is. And then you really want to have a reasonably comprehensive set of questions. Well, they cut those back because they were trying to save cost. And they cut the questions back so heavily that really they were only going to get a head count, age, and immediate relationships. So they were going to miss out on education, on whether people have jobs, some very core things, which if you're doing even a basic census, you'd still want to get that. So that was all missing out. And then, frankly, the experience that we've had from quite a number of different groups asking around on how many people were actually censused, it would appear that a large portion of the population was omitted.
Why are people being critical about the total population that was announced by government?
So how they actually put the numbers together is a bit of a mystery. They say they used all kinds of devices to make up or to secure the numbers, even in the absence of direct questioning of households. I was amused when some people were saying, oh, the census officers came around to their place, but they didn't actually have even a pen or a pencil amongst them. So I'm not sure quite what sort of census they were in, information they were trying to gather. You know, a census operation has to be a professional and impartial exercise.
How are we when it comes to accountability during census?
Even though the census budget allocation was not as large, certainly as the National Statistical Office wanted, and was less than in the previous census in terms of if you extrapolate for inflation and population growth and so on. So the numbers were not so large, but you need to have a very tight oversight process for the census figures. And I'm not sure, maybe those figures were fully accounted for, but as we know, one of our problems in PNG is lack of audits and lack of budget accountability. So we should get reporting on that in next year, in the mid-year economic and fiscal outlook report from this year, but particularly also from the end of year reporting. But we need to see the details of the numbers, because as we know, it was meant to have been completed in 2024, but a lot of the subsequent work was still going on in 2025.
Paul Barker from the Institute of National Affairs. Pacific Beat has sought comment from the PNG government. Today, Timor-Leste is marking the 50th anniversary of its independence proclamation. It's one of the most important national days for the people of Timor, and there'll be gatherings to mark this special day. The ABC's reporter in Dili, Vonia Vieira, with more.
It was on November 28, 1975, that the Revolutionary Front for an Independent East Timor declared their unilateral proclamation of independence from Portugal, marking the beginning of a long and arduous journey towards sovereignty and self-determination. Dr. Mariel Katiri, along with Nicola Lobato and Francisco Xavier do Amaral, read the proclamation. The former Prime Minister shared his thoughts about the day 50 years ago.
A very special day for all of us. We knew at the time that we were not ready to do the things, to be leaders of a state building, leaders of a nation. But our generation has to have to do something for the liberation of our country and of our people. That's why with the 20 years old plus, we decided to challenge the challenge. And we really decided to do it.
The former Prime Minister says there is a mixture of emotion when he reflects on Timor history.
Sad because we have been really governing the country in such a way that I do not agree. And happy because I'm still alive, still being active and trying to do my best.
9 days after independence from Portugal was declared, Indonesia launched a full-out invasion. Selina Ximenes de Jesus, one of the survivors, remembers the hunger, displacement, and war.
Memories that I cannot forget include the suffering that began in 1975. The suffering was overwhelming and varied, involving the need to leave home, endure hunger, and face illness. Many people could not go to school. They had to flee due to fear, the effects of war.
She hopes that Indonesia can acknowledge the violence they committed 50 years ago.
I want Indonesia to recognize their mistakes, as they were wrong. They entered Timor illegally, destroyed a lot, triggered a war, shot people dead, made many flee, and caused immense suffering.
Fernando Ximenez, a researcher on history and economy, told to the ABC, state the long process of independence is now a time for reflecting.
We have been colonized by the Portuguese for almost 5 centuries. We have been occupied by the Indonesian regime for 24 years, and we have struggled to conquer our independence. I think these 50 years of since the Declaration of National Independence should be a time to reflect. It's for everyone, for the politician, for the political party, especially those who worked since the early time of independence struggle. Those people are what we consider as the elders, as the leading generation of 1975.
50 years on after the proclamation, how do young people feel about it? For Pascuela Zona Branco, it's about the struggle of her elders.
I think with the sacrifices that maybe my grandparents have during the past, especially not having the same education that I'm currently having now, I think that is something that I really cherish, and I really ensure that I use my opportunity right now very wisely in any ways I can.
She also grateful that things have changed for the better with improvement in the lives of women of her generation.
During the war, not all women have the opportunity, but I also come to realize that a lot of women in the past contribute to the independence of this country.
For Ricardo Valenti Araozo, today is about deep reflection on the proclamation.
We need to always have it in our mind, and contributing and also doing things should be reflected on resilience and the fight that our fighters back then fought to get their independence.
Maria Alkatiri became prime minister when Timor-Leste became a nation in 2002. Today, he says, the future is bright, but challenges remain with investment needed in education, health, and the economy.
To free the people means investing in education, first of all, investing in health, and a sustainable and resilient economy.
Dr. Mari Alkatiri, Timor-Leste's first prime minister, ending that report from Vonia Vera in Dili. It's Friday, November 28th, and you're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia, live from Papua New Guinea's capital, Port Moresby. If you're just tuning in, surfers wanting to catch a wave in Fiji could pay or soon have to pay, with the government moving to hand back exclusive beach access to resorts. Meanwhile, a prominent economist has raised concerns or questions as to whether PNG's population is really what the census says it is.
Frankly, the experience that we've had from quite a number of different groups asking around on how many people were actually censused, it would appear that a large portion of the population was omitted.
Stay tuned, because coming up, we are going to look at how banking scammers are targeting seasonal workers.
What's your favourite view where you live in the Pacific? Grab your phone or your camera and take a pic of it, because Nisha Daily is running a photo competition. We're looking for photos which represent you and your part of the Pacific. Anyone can enter, you don't have to be a professional, and there are prizes up for grabs. So get snapping and send us a photo in WhatsApp of your favourite view. It's +61 437 519 385. That's +61 437 519 385. And tune in to Nisha Daily weekdays from 7 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia for all the details.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Over the past week, Tonga's King Tupou VI has been in China on a state visit, where he met with President Xi Jinping. However, President Ching pledged fresh investments for Tonga, and a number of agreements were also signed. Tonga's government is still paying off construction loans taken out 2 decades ago, now totaling $112 million. On the line is Tonga scholar and political commentator Malachi Toloa Matangi. Malachi, a very good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
Firstly, this is not the first time that Tonga's king had visited Beijing, but one thing is noticeable is that it occurred just as Tonga's general election results came out. Is this a coincidence?
His Majesty, as you say, is not unfamiliar with China and the relationship that Tonga has with China. The timing of His Majesty's visit to China, I think, was meant to be earlier on in the year, but it's just logistics, I think. It just so happened that he was, His Majesty was over in China when the elections were taking place. I don't think there's anything we should read much into it. I think it was just the way that the logistics had taken place.
Yes, President Xi has indicated more investment for Tonga. Does this cause concern? Many observers say Beijing's funding intends to put countries into a debt trap as well.
Yeah, sure. Look, you mentioned earlier that Tonga has took a soft loan from China for the reconstruction of the capital after the riots of 1611. And they still, the country is still paying debt off. And of course, now, on the other hand, the Chinese have indicated that they will invest more in Tonga in terms of economics, infrastructure, and that kind of thing. I mean, yeah, you could ask the question. I mean, we have a debt on one hand, whilst on the other, China is offering more investment. I think it should be a cause of concern that how Tonga will pay off the debt. On the other hand, it's the way that the Chinese are normally working in the Pacific at the moment, as you would know, is offering investments in to these nations who sorely need the investment, obviously. What the terms are, we don't know, but it is something to be, I guess, careful of, that we don't, that the government doesn't fall into to more debt than what is serviceable by the country.
Malakai, could you tell us a little bit more about how important Tonga's relationship is with China? In the past, China had been the biggest foreign donor to Tonga and still continues to contribute a significant amount, right?
Yeah, sure. I mean, Tonga's foreign policy can be phrased in the statement that Tonga is a friend of everyone and no enemy, and not an enemy of anyone. So Tonga is open, in terms of its foreign policy, it's open to relationships with other countries. It's just at the moment that China is making all the moves and sharing it, as it's doing with other Pacific nations. And Tonga looks at who is on, who is coming, who is offering the investments, the assistance, and so forth. So, I mean, Tonga also has relations with Australia, New Zealand, the US, the UK, and of course, with other Pacific nations. So China is one of those nations. It just so happens that China is the most prominent at the moment.
The $112 million US loan that Tonga owes China, I'm referring to the loan that was used to fund the reconstruction of Nuku'alofa's CBD when most of it was burnt down in the riots of 2006. Will Tonga be able to pay off this debt?
A good question. As you probably would know, that the Tonga's government's budget is a lot of it's funded, in fact, around 50% is funded from overseas, overseas direct investments and so forth, and foreign transfers. So the question whether the country can pay off the 112 odd million US dollars that it's that makes up its debt is, of course, a difficult question to answer. But on the face of it, on the surface, of course it can't. So the terms of the loan, the repayments, of course, controlled by China, and keeping good relationship with China, of course, will help Tonga to carry the debt or pay the debt off as soon as it could. Right?
And how much has this loan impacted Tonga's foreign affairs? Beijing has had to extend the repayment date. Do you think this comes with strings attached?
Look, all investments by foreign countries in the Pacific come with strings attached. I mean, there's no free lunch, if you're supposed to say. It depends on the one hand, on what what the investments are at the terms and conditions. And on the other hand, what Tonga and I guess other countries in the Pacific can carry realistically, because we're talking shoestring budgets here, and to carry extra loan repayments and so forth, of course, that's very, very difficult. And so it's the Tonga government or the Caretaker government at the moment has made it a point to try and wean Tonga off foreign dependency, and I guess that is related to what we're talking about. So, and that's of course a big call, and it takes a long time for Tonga to grow its own internal economy, domestic economy, in order for it to wean itself off the foreign investment.
Right now, Tonga's elected candidates are discussing who their next prime minister and cabinet will be. Is Beijing viewed favorably by Tonga's politicians as a foreign partner?
I think in terms of economics, of course, Beijing is viewed favorably by all governments. I mean, in Tonga, I guess, in other trade nations. As far as I know, that it doesn't look that the Chinese, on the surface, at least, not interested in meddling with politics, if you put it that way, internal politics of Tonga. It wants a relationship that is conducive to forging a partnership between China and Tonga that's of mutual benefit to both countries. So that doesn't include, in my view, meddling in politics.
And that was Tonga's scholar and political commentator, Malachi Koloa Matangi.
Kick off your Sunday with Kuntamari Crofts on Pacific Sundays, right here on ABC Radio Australia. Pacific Sundays is a laid-back weekly wrap of all things Pacific, from news, sport, and entertainment to the best island music vibes. So whether you're chilling out, heading off to church, or catching up with family, be entertained as you do it with Pacific Sundays. Every Sunday at 6 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Seasonal and palm scheme workers in Australia are being advised to stay vigilant and not share their personal details with anyone. It follows an alert issued by Commonwealth Bank warning about scams targeting seasonal workers. Simon Birmingham, the CEO of the Australian Banking Association, told Lucy Cooper the workers are particularly vulnerable.
Australia's banks are always on the lookout for scams that might be ripping off all of their customers, be they Australian citizens, seasonal workers or others banking through the Australian banking system. And Commonwealth Bank have recently identified particular risks in relation to dodgy loan or credit scams where seasonal workers, palm scheme workers are being trapped into potentially providing upfront payments for loans, giving away account details. The type can see them lose money for products that definitely are not coming from banks and for people who are only pretending to be acting on behalf of banks.
What kind of scams would traditionally target seasonal workers?
We see with these types of loan or credit scams is that Pacific workers are being asked to provide upfront payments and application fee for loans, which they shouldn't be facing, that they are being asked to give away certain account access details, which nobody should ever do, and that they are potentially sometimes even still being lumbered with credit products and loans that are not wise for them to have, or that they don't actually know about, because by giving away information, people are then going and writing these loans on their behalf without their knowledge.
Are seasonal workers considered to be a more vulnerable group or more at risk of being scammed?
Any one of us can potentially be scammed, and we see Australians and people all around the world of all educational standards and backgrounds being scammed. But certainly lower levels of financial literacy, less exposure to banking products and how loans and credit facilities work increase the risk that somebody may be scammed. In the case of Pacific workers and Palm Scheme workers, the risk there is that they may not have had that same exposure, are unlikely to, in fact, of more sophisticated banking products, of how Australian banks work and of credit schemes. And that means that unscrupulous people can come along and are coming along and targeting these workers, trying to get them to sign up to processes where it's sold as you can get more money faster. And that more money faster, though, is either a complete scam or entrapping people in loans that they don't really need and wouldn't necessarily want if they fully understood it.
What tips do you have for seasonal workers to avoid being scammed?
People need to be really careful to avoid using unknown agents or brokers who just approach them out of the blue. If they need financial support, to make sure they are going through upfront with banks or through other trusted sources in terms of their PALM employers and coordinators who can help them. And that PALM workers, just like everybody else, should never be giving away or providing internet banking passwords, one-time codes, or any access to their accounts for other people to get into those bank accounts.
Where can seasonal workers access help if they need it?
So the help is really there to go through PALM employers, coordinators, and those who've helped them into Australia, but also to go definitely to banks, particularly if people think they have been scammed or an attempted scam is underway, to contact their bank and let them know. To Scam Watch is an important source as well. And if they've shared identity documents, then ID Care is a support service that can help people deal with the fact they may have given away parts of their identification and how to restore protection of that identity.
And that's Simon Birmingham, the Chief Executive Officer of the Australian Banking Association. And switching gears now to sports, it's another year and yet another revamped version of the World Rugby 7 Series kicks off in Dubai this weekend. Fiji goes into the event as last year's winners, while Fijiana won't want to repeat their wooden spoon performance from 12 months ago. With only 8 teams in the elite groups now, Samoa has missed out, but they know what they have to do to get back to the top. Here's Richard Uwat with more.
The Fijians began and ended last season's World Series with a bang, taking out the first tournament in Dubai and the last in Singapore. But the side faded when it came to the grand final in Los Angeles and ended up in seventh spot. Now head coach Jose Colonassau has a very simple plan, which he believes can take his team to the world title this time.
We know that when we keep the ball for a long time, we score a lot of tries. We use the ball pretty well and the talent we have. And, you know, if we keep the ball for a long time, we always score, as it shows in our analysis. The longer we keep the ball, we break teams down easily.
But the coach knows his side has to defend as well or risk the consequences, and he wants all his players involved.
You can see me shouting at the boys, chase back, you know, vocal about it. Because I know if, you know, we work hard in attack, we should always work hard in defense as well. And something I'm telling the boys, if we're good in defense, it's not a guarantee, but we're going to be 80% there during the final when it comes around if we're really good in defense.
Fijiana had a better time of it at grand final, finishing fifth, and they'll be looking to build on that with some young, new players in the ranks. But coach Richard Walker echoes Asea Colonassau's sentiments. Fijian flair with ball in hand is great, but not so good if you leak tries at the other end.
The biggest thing we learned from last year is to really focus on our defense. We know Fijians are just naturally gifted attackers, so there's not really much that we need to teach them on that side. We just probably need to teach them some structure and when they get into trouble of how to get out of trouble using their teammates. So we're really focusing on the defensive side, so we hope that it comes to fruition in Dubai.
And new partnerships struck by the Fiji Rugby Union have helped with team preparation. Osea Colonassau is grateful to both their hosts and to Qatar, whose input has allowed Fiji to get a head start in Dubai.
Dubai were taking second place, and there's going to be five players that are going to play for Dubai Invitational outside, and those players will play. If we have an injury, we can just select from the five that are there. That's why we are excited, and excited especially with UAE Rugby giving us an opportunity, and Qatar Rugby as well, paying for us to come early, and we want to thank them, then that's allowing us to prepare really well.
Meanwhile, Fiji's long-time rivals Samoa now know the pathway they have to follow to get back to the elite group. Their journey will also begin in Dubai in mid-January when they take on Belgium, Canada, Colombia, Hong Kong, Italy, Madagascar and Tonga. The Tongan Rugby Union were on the brink of scrapping their sevens team on funding grounds, but it would seem the new look competition has persuaded them to carry on. So the ideal result would be for Tonga and Samoa to finish top two, because that would mean progress to Division Two, where the winning team, after three rounds in Kenya, Uruguay and Brazil, would secure promotion to the top level. And Samoa's women's team are also in the mix with the chance to follow the same route to the top as the Manu.
Richard Ewart with that look ahead at the new rugby, World Rugby Sevens, which kicks off in Dubai tomorrow, with Fijiana playing the USA first up, while Fiji men's first match will be against Argentina.
Pacific Beat.
The battle to represent the Pacific at the 2007 FIFA Women's World Cup in Brazil is about to begin, with Oceania's preliminary round kicking off in Rarotonga. Host nation Cook Islands will be vying with Tonga, Tahiti and American Samoa to secure the one spot that is available in the main qualifying tournament to be hosted by Solomon Islands and Fiji next February. Marisa Halam from OFC's media team is in the Cooks, and she says it's all to play for right from the start when Tonga takes on American Samoa and Tahiti play the Cooks tomorrow.
Yeah, so basically they are competing in a knockout format over the two match days for the spot, with Group A in round two against New Zealand, Samoa and the Solomon Islands.
So big prize at stake for them. Of the four teams that are there, how would you rate their chances? Let's start with the host nation, first of all, Cook Islands. Do you feel that the fact that they are the host gives them a bit of an advantage?
They definitely do have a lot of support behind them as the home team. They do have a new coach at the moment, Reese Rooker. After finishing eighth at the Women's Nations Cup, Reese has come in to do a more system-driven selection, combining the youth and the senior players for this tournament.
And Tonga, they're an interesting team. History suggests that they've been one of the stronger teams over the years in OFC, but perhaps not in recent times. They're perhaps going through a rebuilding phase.
Yeah, so with their rebuilding phase, Coach Kilifi has decided to go with a team that is more locally based for this one as well. So he's really focused on blending the youth players into this from the under-16s and under-19s. As at Women's Nations Cup, they had quite a few players from the States.
American Samoa, they weren't involved at all in World Cup qualifying last time because I think of issues linked to the pandemic, but they're there this time, and my understanding is they've been looking to recruit players from the diaspora, from the United States, to strengthen their team.
Yeah, so maybe over half their players in this squad are from the States. So this is their first debut in a long time for the women's qualifying. So they do have a squad mix with youth and veterans as well, just focusing on the long-term growth of American Samoa. So it will be really interesting to see them come up against Tonga, Cook Islands and Tahiti.
And Tahiti, the fourth team in the mix here. Women's football, I think, in Tahiti, certainly at national level, is still somewhat in its infancy, really, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure. So they've basically got the same squad as they did at the Women's Nations Cup. They've been going through more rigorous training.
So how do you see the tournament playing out?
Basically, with this whole knockout setting, they've got a lot riding on their first games to go into that final to move on to the next round. From being at Women's Nations Cup, you know, Tahiti, Tonga and Cook Islands were all in the bottom few with the results. So it would actually be really interesting to see them come up against American Samoa, who have majority of their squad being from the USA.
And I'm wondering also, the fact that the setup in the World Cup has changed now, and we know that there are spots available potentially for two teams from Oceania. And the assumption, of course, is always that New Zealand will take the automatic place, and then one of the Pacific Island teams might end up in the final qualifier. Last time it was Papua New Guinea. Clearly, you wouldn't expect it to be one of these four teams, but that has to be their ambition.
Yeah, that's all their end goals. And I think that's what's happening with the teams, is that they're trying to grow their local talent so that they can reach that level as well. It's anyone's game, really, in this tournament.
Marisa Halam there from the OFC media team on the line from Rarotonga, and she was speaking to Richard Iowat. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Recapping our top stories, surfers wanting to catch a wave in Fiji could soon have to pay, with the government moving to hand back exclusive beach access to resorts.
That is designed to A, liberalize access to all the marine areas, and B, to ensure that the resort owners are compensated.
We'll be back at the same time Monday. That's at 6 a.m. PNG time. You can also hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time with Eggy Tupo. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because news is next, and coming up after that is Nija Daily. I'm Belinda Cora, coming to you live from Port Moresby. Thanks for joining me this morning, and have a nice day.